And, of course, our special guest, Catherine Austin Fitz. And we're going to come back and take your calls as we continue chatting with her about, geez, what the future holds for us next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, before we hit the litany of phone calls here, war. China seems to be ramping up some things with those islands. Taiwan's not happy. Japan's not happy. We're not happy. Russia's doing things with Iran. The Middle East is still up and down. How does it feel to you? To me, it feels like there's going to be a war.
I think the number one risk in the economy is war. And it's both covert war, which has been obviously going on for a long time, but overt war as well. I think the tensions are great. And part of it is this shift from a unipolar world where the U.S. basically played global cop to a world where, you know, we're no longer in a position to do that. We keep trying because of protecting our role as reserve currency, and things get very jerky between us and Russia and China, and the sort of the dance to keep Russia and Germany apart. So I think tensions are way too high, and I think it is the single greatest weight on the global economy, combined with a lack of confidence that the leadership can really sort of handle it.
I think so, too. I think so, too. Got an email in from someone who's one of your fans and says, George, how could you force Catherine to go on the air like that and strain her voice? So you tell everybody this was Catherine's idea.
They have no idea. I think I'm almost back to normal. You should have heard me 2 weeks ago.
We had you scheduled 2 weeks ago, too.
I know. You've been very generous. No, I really wanted, I had so much to talk about, George. It's very hard for me to be quiet when the market is this wild.
There's just so much going on. I mean, my gosh. What do you do for investments, Catherine? And I'm saying this rhetorically now. What do you do with everything so topsy-turvy? I mean, I like silver, for example, not just because Lear Capital likes it. I like it.
The number one thing you do is you pay down debt. If you have any debt at all, you pay it off. You know, because if you look at returns, they're volatile, or, you know, the steady returns are low. So this is an environment, if there's any way you can pay off your debt, you know, you absolutely want to do it. The second thing, George, is because of the volatility, you want to stay very balanced. What you don't want to do is get scared out of everything. So let's look at gold and silver. We've had an incredible run-up at the beginning of the year. So gold is now up about 13%, silver up about 10%. But if you go back to last year, gold and silver at on January 23rd, silver was up 16% for the year. In 2015, gold up 10%, and they ended down the year negative 12 and negative 11%.
Right.
So you have to be really careful. If you look at the charts and you look at the markets, we are at a major inflection point, both for the U.S. dollar and for precious metals. And you have to be very careful, because if the dollar takes another, you know, it's been correcting by a minor amount this year, but if it returns up to 100 or it takes another leg up, gold and silver are going to go through more correction. Now, I believe the primary trend on gold and silver is up.
Me too.
The only caveat on that is I go back to our conversation about energy. If we get a real evolution in technology, including in energy, it can have a dramatic shift in support of equities over precious metals. So just keep that in mind. And that's why it's very important that you stay very balanced. I have a post on my website, if you come in and do a search, called "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?" where I go through the detail of how you figure that out. One of my favorite quotes is, always have some gold to bribe the border guards. And so I absolutely believe you have to have a core position in gold and silver, because it's the one thing on this planet you can put in your pocket and walk anywhere and it will be recognized as money. It really is money. So always have some gold and silver to bribe the border guards is what I say.
Any more talk about run on banks or banks keeping your money or anything like that?
Banks have a big problem because we have pumped the financial markets and the financial, you know, we pumped it up and up and up. And by using monetary policy and not fiscal policy to keep the game going, we've got way too much financialization of the economy. And the question is, how do you cut it back? How do you wind the game down and get it to a point where financial markets support building up the real economy, instead of speculation and stripping it down. So what we've seen now is negative interest rates, and this is a big topic in the financial world. Last week, we had over $7 trillion of sovereign bonds go to negative interest rates because people were looking just for a safe place to put their money. So a 10-year Swiss bond was negative. Now, some of that's a currency play, but can you imagine, you know, paying somebody to, to borrow your money?
Yeah.
You know, negative, that's very painful. But it shows you sort of the risk aversion. And what it means is the banks, the insurance companies, the pension funds have a real problem because they need that steady yield. And one of the arguments in support of the equity markets is if you look at those portion of the equity markets that can give you reasonable dividends, you know, all those players ultimately, I think, are going to get forced back into the equity markets. It's part of what we've seen over the last 3 years, but there's a lot more that can happen. The Fed has been really trying to talk up the idea of raising interest rates, and that's because I think they're trying to protect the insurance industry and the pension funds, as well as the banks. But we keep running into this negative interest rate problem, and the banks are really going to have to downsize.
The late Jimmy Hoffa once told me, Catherine, that his Teamster pension fund investments in the Vegas, albeit the mob, were some of the best returns he's ever had.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. Now, I don't know if you know this, but you know, there's a great book on the history of Las Vegas by Sally Denton and Roger Morris. And one of the big investors in Las Vegas, the original big investors, was the Mormons.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating.
That's funny.
The story of the Mormons financing Las Vegas is a fascinating story. You know, I've always believed to a certain extent Las Vegas was created to launder the money for Area 51.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. But but Hoffa said they made a lot of money.
I'm sure they did.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, go ahead.
Good morning to Coast family.
Hello, Wayno. How are you?
Okay. Yes, Ms. Fitz, I am completely honored to be talking to you. And thank you 1,000 times for coming on. When you're not feeling well, we really appreciate it.
Well, Wayne, I appreciate talking to you.
Yes, thank you. What I want to ask you about was, like, I was reading this article about one of the Russian former central bankers, and the Russian people over there with mortgages, the mortgages are denominated in foreign currency, so they're really having a tough time because of the weakened ruble.
Right.
What I really wanted to ask you about was, back in the day, because I've been listening to you forever, you and George talk, and you had said that I think you were at a conference and the stockholders were asked, well, we can substantially eliminate crime in the neighborhoods of America, but it's going to knock a lot of money off the share price of your stock. Who wants to stand up and do the right thing? And nobody stood up. So could you just briefly explain the process of the money laundering that goes on to allow this system to exist? And thank you so much for coming on, and thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
I think you were referring to one of two meetings, so I'll just collapse it, you know, because there were two issues. One is I had a board on one of my subsidiary companies in 1997. We had a wonderful team of the top pension funds in the country, including the president of CalPERS. And we made a presentation on how you could re-engineer the federal budget and create, you know, the equivalent of, you know, think of it as mutual funds or stock markets for local neighborhoods, so that you could really significantly lower the cost to capital to small business and grow small business and employment dramatically in a way that would make a lot of money for the pension funds. And the president of CalPERS said, this is fantastic, but the problem is they've decided to move all the money out of the country. They've given up on the country. You've got to get to Nick Brady, who was the former Secretary of Treasury, and my former partner, Dylan Reed. And he was really concerned about the fact that they'd kind of given up on the country. And the problem was this: if you allowed capital and transparency about government money to flow to small business, then you wouldn't have been able to centralize enormous amounts of capital in big corporations. And I think the concern at the top was, one, they wanted to pull a lot of money out of the economy fast, and they could do that by bubbling the economy. But two, they wanted to aggregate everything into big corporations. I have a great online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I think you linked to it, George,
yeah,
from the page that you have on me. It's at dunwalkie.com, and it tells the whole story and gives an example. And the bubbling of the economy really fooled the general population into thinking that the economy, the American economy, was fine. And as a result, a great deal of money was sucked out. While we basically liquidated our capital with the debt bubble and the housing bubble, and by the time, we hit the bailouts and it was too late, the problem was the bailouts doubled down. It's why I call it a financial coup. And so the point of writing the Dylan Reed book and putting it online was to make sure people knew this was a plan. I don't know if you remember, it's funny you brought up Newt Gingrich, George. Newt Gingrich kept running around in 1996 saying we should give every kid in America a laptop. What he and a whole bunch of people in Washington were trying to do is say, hey, let's help the American people jump the curve on new technology and globalization and stay in the game. And there was another group that said, no, you can't trust the American people. Let's just bubble the economy and shift all the money out. And that's exactly what happened. But by writing the book, what I tried to make clear was there was a real debate. In my opinion, the good guys lost the debate. And unfortunately, what we did was we had a financial coup d'etat. And now part of the problem you're watching in Washington, all the money is out. And now the question is, well, what's the exit plan here? Now we have the liabilities with the assets shifted out. How are we going to deal with this? And nobody in Washington wants to turn around to the people and tell the truth.
I love that. By the way, did you ever see Green Acres when you were a kid?
Yeah.
You know who you sound like tonight?
Oh, no.
Mr. Haney.
Well, I'm talking to you from Hickory Valley, Tennessee. How appropriate.
Mr. Haney. Let's go now to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hey, Barry.
Hello there, George.
It's Mr. Haney.
Huh?
Nothing, just babbling today, Barry.
Okay, that Catherine is fun to listen to. I swear she is. But when you said something about Green Acres, I thought she was going to say she sounded like Ava Gabor.
No, Mr. Haney tonight.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. A couple quick comments. I got a good question for Catherine. I'm always saying long-time listener, frequent caller.
Yes, you are.
That Cornelius in Lafayette, Louisiana, that son of a gun can get through it better than I can, and it's driving me crazy.
He's got a special system, I think.
Well, I do too, in a way. I've got speed call. I can get one call in every 7 seconds.
The secret is you do it with, you want me to tell you?
Yeah.
You do it with two phones simultaneously.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
You got a cell phone in one, you got your landline in the other, and you're both hitting those numbers. Boom, boom, boom. That's the secret.
Right.
I've given it away after 13 years.
Oh, gosh, and now everybody's going
to know. Now everybody knows. So anyways, go ahead.
One other quick comment. I'm telling you, these Tuesday night open lines is one of the best ideas you've come up with. And I like it. And one other quick one, rock and roll show once a month. You did one a month or so ago, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we ought to have our friend Billy Gibbons and ZZ Top on there real soon. And Billy's allowed to meet you in the studio and talk.
Oh, Billy's one great guy. I should bring the whole band in and let them play live in the studio here.
Oh, good gosh, and I wish it would be, I'm nationwide.
But go ahead for a question with Catherine while you got her.
All right, yes, Catherine, I'm sure you can hear me and all. Wonderful talk tonight. And listen, we have just got to do something about the Supreme Court Justice, what's his name, please?
Scalia.
No,
the one who just died.
Yes, for God's sakes, for heaven's sakes, under those circumstances, George, there just got to be an autopsy done.
Of course.
On these people.
A pillow over his head?
Yeah, for heaven's sakes, he didn't do it himself.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think you can, but anyway, it's just ridiculous, and I'd love to hear Catherine.
All right, let's get your take on that a little bit more, Catherine. I do think that President Obama does have the right now to appoint a new justice. I mean, he's going to be president for a year, 11 more months. I mean,
right.
He can't be a lame duck that bad.
Right. I think it would be irresponsible for a sitting president to leave it empty. The question is, how do you do something that will,
he's got to pick a moderate. He's got to pick someone who's not too far left. Definitely, he's not never going to pick someone too far right, so he needs a moderate.
Because I think this is a very important point. I'd like to read to you what President Reagan said when he swore in Justice Scalia. He said, quote, "The warning more than a century ago attributed to Daniel Webster remains as timeless as the document be revered. Miracles do not cluster," Webster said. "Hold on to the Constitution of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. Hold on to your Constitution, for if the American Constitution shall fall, there will be an anarchy throughout the world."
I like that.
Now,
that's special.
I believe that is absolutely true. I think one of the reasons I was such an admirer of Scalia was he really made an extraordinary effort to constantly bring the court back to the Constitution. He understood the importance of the Constitution, and I think it is imperative at this time, no matter how wild the debates, George, that we all reaffirm our covenant to the existing Constitution and the importance of enforcing and upholding the existing Constitution. And that starts not in Washington, but in the hearts and minds of the people. And so I think when we talk about one of the reasons I would like to see a serious a look into this, what happened to Scalia, is it's part of really maintaining that covenant of the Constitution. You cannot uphold a Constitution if the people who enforce the Constitution are afraid for their lives.
Well, and they are.
They are.
That's the problem.
They are, right.
You know, they've lost confidence in government. They're mad as hell, and they don't want to take it anymore.
Right.
If we could coin that old phrase from the movie Network, how apropos was that, huh? A long time ago.
Very apropos.
Hey, Catherine, we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take some final phone calls with you, and then open lines begin next hour for a couple hours. We do this during the week now. We found that we can do the strange, unusual, and the scary on Fridays, but during the week, it's generally wide open, so anything goes, including the scary, the unusual, and the weird. But just special open lines. We're with Catherine Austin Fitz. Her website, solari.com, solari.com. Back with your final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Catherine Austin Fitz with us. We'll get your calls in just a second. Catherine, of everything you do with what you do, what is your favorite thing? What do you enjoy doing?
Oh, you know what I enjoy doing? I enjoy working for people. You know, I always say, it's funny because when Wayne called in from Chicago, I always say I used to work for people I didn't like, and now I get to work for people I really like.
That's right.
I work for our subscribers, I work for my clients and audience, and it's amazing. You know, one of my favorite expressions is nobody is smart as all of us, and my business really evolved out of doing radio shows and answering questions and, you know, having to go figure things out because I'd gotten a question. And I always compliment the Coast audience, who, you know, I love, because I used to think, you know, why does everybody think space is so important? I kept trying to get people interested in infrastructure and roads and bridges, and it was the Coast audience who eventually taught me, no, you know, the whole economy is really organized around putting money into space through the black budget. And if you look at the orbital platform, it's where all the control is coming from. And, you know, they've really, I've grown tremendously because I've been working and listening to people from, you know, all over the world. And so it's an amazing learning journey for me. You know, the future is coming for us, George, is really what's happening. And I feel a lot better about my future because, you know, I've been able to really stay on the ground and be learning and in cahoots with so many people around the world. And so, you know, so I feel very positive about my future, although I feel a lot of concern for the pain people are feeling by going through this change.
Well, you've been doing a great job, I think, personally and professionally for so many people, Catherine, during what I believe to be still very trying times. I think it's going to be a bumpy road, much bumpier than
seven and eight. Very bumpy and much bumpier than it has to be. But part of it is I feel like I sort of went through it early, and unfortunately, I tried to warn people they couldn't understand what I was saying, and now they can. You know, and I hate to see it, but I kind of feel like I'm welcoming everybody to my world.
Great. You know, Trump is still talking about a third-party run because one of the things we're predicting is the possibility of a brokered convention and that they end up picking Jeb Bush. Our psychics believe that's going to happen. I think it could happen.
You know, early on, I thought that Trump was going to white everybody out and leave the pathway open for Bush. And but as things have played out, I just think Bush's legacy problems, you know, he's got a lot of money and a lot of endorsements. I just don't see how he can do it without
being handpicked. And that's the only way he could do it is a brokered convention.
Well, but here's the thing. If there's too much dirty tricks, computer rigging, you know, the kind of things that worked in the Gore-Bush election, if those happen, George, it's going to tear the country apart. So I don't think the Republicans can afford that kind of, you know, that's why I wonder if...
No, it's not going to be that. It's going to be where they can't decide with the delegates who's going to get the nomination. So they all go in there, and the delegates then are free to do what they want to do and vote for whoever they're going to vote.
Then you buy the delegates.
Then you buy the delegates. That's right. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Stephanie in Fremont, California to get this segment going. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, George. Well, I'm not too impressed by what Mrs. Fitz is saying. She really made my jaw drop when she called Bernie Sanders a public servant. My definition of a public servant is not someone who gets into office and promises all these goodies and then turns around and robs the people blind with extremely high taxes.
Well, that's a definition of a politician.
She referred to Bernie Sanders as a public servant. And she said, when John Boehner was Speaker of the House, he said Bernie Sanders never met a tax hike he didn't like.
Oh, I'm sure he's a tax maven.
Remembers that.
Yeah,
Uncle Bernie is not going to give you all these freebies and write a personal check. It's coming out of everybody else's checkbook. But I want to defend Donald Trump. Donald Trump built a billion-dollar empire on making good deals, okay? When she says he is against more Muslim immigration to the U.S., and if he did that, the Muslims would pull their money out of our economy. First of all, despite Obama's many attempts to destroy our economy, America is still the best place to do business with. And if Donald Trump, I pray, gets in the White House, we will be an even stronger country. There is no way these Muslim countries are going to stop doing business with us. And let me remind her, most of these Muslim countries did not even want to take the Muslim immigrants, refugees, fleeing from Syria. So for them to say, if we don't want them, well, we're just going to pull our money out of America, totally hypocritical. It's not going to happen. Like I said, if Trump gets in the White House, they will beg to do business with us. I completely disagree with Mrs. Fitz.
Well, and you have that right. That's what's so wonderful about this program. And, Catherine, you have the right to rebut.
I agree. First of all, let me absolutely agree with our caller, because I disagree with almost everything Bernie Sanders ever says. So, and I agree. I think the last thing we need is more government and taxes. So I don't agree with Bernie Sanders, but I think he is sincere I think he is a public servant. I think he believes in what he's doing. I agree completely with what you said about taxes. At the same time, if you look at the record of some of the candidates in terms of criminal behavior and global racketeering of the most unethical, if not illegal, kind, you know, if you haven't read the book Clinton Clash, I just recommend it. I would say that Donald Trump built a business in casino and in high-end real estate, and if you look at the methods with which he did it, you know, I would defer to you that it was good deals for the American people. I would encourage you. There's a book review on my website called it's on Addiction by Design, about machine gambling and some of the practices in the gambling industry. So, you know, I just think whatever he is, Donald Trump is not what I would consider a public servant. That doesn't mean that I agree with everybody who is a public servant. So I think there are also public servants in the race on the other side who philosophically are much more aligned. Finally, I'm a great believer in a global economy of judging people on their actions and not lumping them all into a group. So I have a problem saying Muslims are this, because it's a much more complex, fractured world. And so when we label people and play divide and conquer, I think we are pushing our culture and our economy into a war economy. We now spend $1.7 trillion overtly and even more covertly, as you know, George, globally on war. If we're going to survive as a civilization, then we need to evolve to a much more peaceful and collaborative economy, which we can, but we can if we're spending trillions of dollars every year on military and we not only fight on this planet, but we take the war into space in the orbital platform and with space weaponry. So I think we've got to tone down and start talking about facts, not lumping people into bad guy, good guy groups.
In 2 weeks, we're going to have Super Tuesday, March 1st. Can you believe we're going to go into March already, by the way? This is a we were talking about how fast last year was. This year has every makeup of going faster than any year we've ever had. But we'll have Super Tuesday. We'll see how all the candidates fare coming out of that one, because that's a big day in many states.
That's big delegates.
Yep, sure is. And that's the foothold for the beginning of whether they make it or not. And so we will see what happens on that day. Let's go next to Michael in Long Island, New York. You're on the air with us, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. This is Michael. I'm here in Suffolk County, New York.
Hi.
Sitting intently. Hello.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a yuppie from the 80s. I worked at Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette.
Oh, and, great.
Yes, and I'm the unlikely analyst from the 80s. But my question is, really, Bernie Sanders could be the next president.
He could be.
And he is a socialist.
He is.
Right.
So
that's going to scare the markets to death.
Let's say he wants to spend a lot of money and give it to us. Whose pocket is he going to pay?
Yeah, who's going to pay for it? Well, I think he claims Wall Street and companies that have been sending their money overseas, he believes they're going to stay. He's going to force them to stay to spend their money here. I think they'll just all disband, Catherine, and go to other countries.
Yeah, I don't think his solutions are practical, because what we need to do is we need to radically improve productivity, both, you know, whether it's in the financial system or the real economy, and I don't think that's how you do it. I think we've centralized monetary policies has not worked, and centralized fiscal policies are not going to work either.
I've always wanted to say I was with the investment firm of Winken, Blinken, and Nod, which would be interesting. Still with us, Catherine?
Yes.
Okay, I thought we lost you. Heard a little click. Just what we need. You didn't laugh at my joke.
It's, well,
you did hear it, right?
Here's the thing. That I forget who it was. I think Carson said in the Republican debate, you know, this whole thing about free college is a non-starter. You know, our liabilities are way off the charts, and that's what brought up his whole idea of collapse.
First-time caller, Denver, Colorado we go. Christian's with us. Go ahead, Christian.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Yes, Catherine, I just was hoping that you could talk to a little bit to the history of the Davos conferences in Switzerland and what that means to economic policy throughout the planet. I was hoping to also speak to Rand Paul and Donald Trump and hope that they maybe could get together on a neutral platform and, you know, just talk about America. And George, who is the historian that called in as originally as a caller and had all the great information about World War II?
Douglas Dietrich.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Davos, what about that, Catherine?
Well, my impression of Davos is it's not a big decision-making location. It's really a place people get together to discuss and try and find consensus. So it's not a Bilderberger meeting or a Bohemian Grove. What was very interesting, George, is it's at Davos this year, if you saw the fear in the, or what I perceived as fear, obviously I wasn't there, about inequality and the accelerating change in technology and in and sort of how to deal with the potential of mass migration, I think there was real concern in the leadership that they did not know how to deal with the issues and they weren't prepared.
At all. But that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Not like that. I think I perceived a real concern about how to deal with the inequality issue. And of course, you know, they have the same problem that everybody has in this bifurcation between the original sort of the official reality and reality. And that's why if we could do one thing, or really two things, what I would say is we have to bring transparency to the UFO issue and the black budget, because we can't afford this divergence between official reality and reality. It's part of what's driving the disrespect between the general population
and
the leadership.
Were you ever on a panel with the late Edgar Mitchell? We lost him.
I know.
What a shame. Oh. He was a champion for what we looked at. Jason in Missouri. Go ahead, Jason. You're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Catherine, I know that you're not a big Donald Trump fan, but, you know, I'd like to express an opinion to you. You know, I listen to economists like Art Laffer, which, you know, was in the Reagan administration, Tolleston Goolsbee, who was in the Obama administration. And these fluctuations we've been having in the market, I've noticed, wasn't that when Janet Yellen raised the interest rate a half a point, or was it a
0.25?
And we're $19 trillion in debt. And you made another assertion, and I'm not trying to jump on you, because I heard that other caller a while ago. She acted like she was angry at you. I'm not angry at you, but I think Donald, Mr. Trump, everybody's, you know, you said earlier, we need somebody who has executive experience. Well, Mr. Trump has executive experience. He went to the Wharton Business School and graduated at the top of his class. And Mr. Trump not only has gambling, he made his money from casinos, he's made his money from land deals, he's made his money from all kinds of opportunities, golf courses, and he took $1 million and he made it into a multi-billion dollar company. Now, my assertion to you is, that Mr. Trump has been an executive now for 30 years. And
Trump has never served government.
He knows what he's doing.
Well, we've got less than a minute to go, Catherine, 40 seconds.
I completely disagree. I think he's a great casino executive and real estate developer, but that doesn't make him qualified to have a high-level position in government. Now, let me tell you what I like about Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is saying, let's make America great again.
He's got guts.
Right. He's putting up a standard and saying, I want to talk about how we make America great. And I think that's the conversation we have to have. And by putting it down, by laying the marker that we can be great and we want to be great, he's laying the marker and saying, let's have a conversation about how we should be great. And that's the right conversation we should be having. And that's why I think the sort of the big positive in his campaign, because that's the conversation every candidate should be having.
Catherine, take care of that voice, my dear. We'll see you soon. Up next, Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.